Welcome to Pep Talks, where we discuss productive educational practices. I'm Dr. Amy Graham, and I hope to challenge your ideas and attitudes about teaching by hearing different perspectives from valued members of our teaching community at the University of Arizona. Hello and welcome. Today I'm here with Kristen Winnett, who is an associate professor of practice in UCAT at the University of Arizona. And just as a reminder, UCAT stands for the University Center for Assessment, Teaching, and Technology. And she is also a program administrator for CERTL. And CERTL stands for the Center for the Integration of Research, Teaching, and Learning. Thank you for taking your time out to be here with us today.
Thanks, Amy. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm excited to talk with you over the next hour.
Yeah, thank you. So tell me a little bit about yourself.
A little bit about myself. So I am originally from a little town outside of Atlanta, Georgia. So grew up in the South, and I went to the University of Georgia for my bachelor's degree. I double majored in Spanish and comparative world literature. And after that, I ended up at the U of A because I came here for my master's in creative writing. I really wanted to come to the U of A because at the time it was one of the only programs that had a really strong nonfiction track. And that was the genre that I was most interested in working in. So I started teaching here and went straight through and ended up going through my PhD. Got my PhD in rhetoric, composition, and the teaching of English. And from there, you know, sort of moved on to bigger and better things. I'm also a writer and a photographer in my free time. I still manage to do that on the side, mostly related to travel and travel writing and photography. I've got two cats. Their names are Giuseppe and Luigi. They are adorable.
That's nice.
Yeah, they're great. And then I also have two kids, which I don't know why I said the cats before the kids, but I've also got two cute little kids at home, a four-year-old and a two-year-old. So life is keeping me very, very busy right now.
Wow. Yeah, that's impressive. Yeah. Cats and kids. It's wild. You said you do travel photography. So travel writing and travel photography.
Yeah. In my freelance side hustle, I would say. I do a lot of, or I used to. The pandemic kind of changed things a little bit for a while there. But I work with a lot of tourism bureaus, international tourism campaigns, and companies that work in the tourism industry. And I do writing and photography for their websites, for articles that go on, you know, different blogs or in magazines or in-flight magazines, things like that. It keeps me fresh, and it keeps me kind of plugged into, you know, the writing world, you know, because I also am a teacher. And so it's nice to have that outlet in addition to my teaching persona. I think it's important for everybody to have kind of a hobby outside of, you know, their teaching life.
Yeah, your teaching life and your parent life and, yeah, all that stuff. So what's one of the coolest places that you've photographed or written about?
Oh, that's such a great question. One of my favorite places to photograph was, I would say probably a mangrove forest in Malaysia, off the coast of Borneo. It was really beautiful. It's such a beautiful preserve. And I had never seen a mangrove forest before, and I had never done a lot, really any nature photography. And I was working with the tourism bureau there, and I was putting together some images and articles for them about preservation, conservation, about the animals and biodiversity there, which is not my background. So I had to do a lot of really cool research. And I had to photograph monkeys, which are actually really hard to photograph because they're really fast. They're very mischievous creatures. But I had a lot of fun with it. So that's at the top. Yeah.
How cool. Yeah, I think it's just really, it's neat to see that. I think a lot of, particularly for those of us that are instructors, you know, people view us in our teaching roles and they don't realize that we're humans outside of our teaching roles and that we do a lot of cool things on our own free time.
Exactly.
Cool. Okay, so you talked a little bit about your path and how you came from Georgia and you did your undergrad, then you did your graduate work here. And so currently you're a professor of practice, an associate professor of practice in UCAT, and then you also work with CERTL. Can you tell us a little bit about your path to where you are now professionally?
Yeah, and Amy, it's such an interesting question because, you know, when I was originally doing my graduate work, I had this very narrow idea that I would become a tenured professor at a small liberal arts college where I would be teaching only travel writing and journalism. And my career took off in a very different way, in a way that I'm actually really grateful for. So what happened is after I graduated, I did go on to a small liberal arts college to teach writing in that way, in a tenure track position. And I was also tasked with being the writing program administrator for the first year writing program. And during my 4 years there, I realized that I was actually more interested and attracted to some of the administrative components of the job that really surprised me. Like, I loved doing faculty development. I loved hiring new instructors. I loved training. I loved doing book clubs on pedagogy, which is, you know, the art and science of teaching. I really liked doing workshops and summer institutes to help people redesign courses or tune up their syllabus, and just found myself really drawn to that world, which is a part of the field of writing studies that I hadn't really trained for, but that I found really fulfilling in sort of an unexpected way. And so when the chance to come back to the University of Arizona came up in 2019, when I returned here, I jumped at the chance because I was able to bring, you know, the things that I loved about teaching, which was really working with other teachers, even though I still love teaching. I found it really, really rewarding to do the faculty development side. And so I came back to the U of A to work in an interim role in the writing program, which was the program that had sort of, I say, had raised me because I had taught there as a grad student for so many years. And I took on an interim administrative role there for a year. And then the pandemic hit. And at that time, I was approached by Gail Bird, who's our senior vice provost for academic affairs, teaching and learning. And she had been in talks with our writing program director, who I was working closely with. And they had gotten to talking about this new network called CERTL that they were bringing to campus. And a bunch of people had worked on an application to this national network. And we had been accepted and they needed somebody to start up the program. And so they basically, Gail invited me to come take on that new job. It was something I could have never expected, but I jumped at the chance because it sounded really exciting and a new way to use my skills and to meet people from all over campus rather than just, you know, in an English department. You know, one of the things I love about our work is that I meet people and I talk to people every day from fields all over the place. I learned so many cool things by talking to people.
Yes.
So yeah, so I started doing that and that evolved over the past 3 years. And I was hired on officially at a 50-50 split capacity with UCAT and CERTL as of January.
Wow, that's really cool. Gail Bird has a terrific ability to identify talent.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I know that much of my career, I can say pretty decisively that a lot of her programs have really helped me as an instructor. You know, the faculty learning communities, when I got involved with those, it just changed me so much. And it's funny that you're talking about how you were really drawn to these, you know, book clubs, building book clubs about pedagogy. And I never thought that that would be my jam either.
Yeah.
And then it turned out that I really enjoyed it. And it's these kind of moments where you're connecting with other instructors, mm-hmm. Who are passionate about teaching that just brings me a lot of joy. I know. So it's kind of funny. Also the planning aspect. I really enjoy planning things. And so it's kind of a funny thing to hear you say, oh, I actually really enjoyed planning workshops and institutes.
Yeah, like I did not expect that one to coming, but here it is.
Here we are. Yes. No, I know. It's a funny thing how we end up in a weird spot and we're like, how did we get here? But it's good. Anyway,
sometimes it takes someone to recognize that, you know, I may not have ever, like you said, I may not have ever really pursued teaching and learning specifically or faculty development had it not been for somebody who said, hey, you know, you seem really drawn to this. You seem really interested in this. Let's see what you can do over here. You know, so sometimes it takes somebody else to kind of shake you up out of your comfort zone a little bit.
Yeah, I totally agree. And it's important part of leadership is identifying people who have certain talents that maybe they themselves don't recognize.
Absolutely. Well said.
Yeah. I think I have students that are super intense about emailing me. Oh my gosh, I saw you just posted this grade and I believe it should be this. And they're really intense and they're super apologetic about it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I say to them, don't apologize. This is going to be your superpower one of these days. You know, your attention to detail.
So Amy, what's your superpower?
Oh gosh. What is my superpower? I don't know. I think I have, one of my friends told me this, I started a book club over the summer, which perhaps you might want to join us. I don't know.
Love to.
And one of the things that she had said was that I'm really good at connecting with people. And I think that with students, building connections is a really important part. I mostly teach first year college students and I'm teaching them chemistry, which is usually a very intimidating subject. And so building the connection with the students is really beneficial to their development. And so I think that my ability to connect with them and to say, oh, hey, you know, I noticed this, or come to office hours, or talking about my history, my life, helps them recognize that we too, as professors, are humans, and that we all are a work in progress, and it just takes, they have to do the work and build their own path.
I love that. I think that's true. Knowing you, I would say I could see that being your superpower.
Yeah, I don't know. But I'm a planner. There's something very soothing to me about planning and kind of like orchestrating and setting up like parties. I don't always enjoy being at the party, but like prepping for the party, such a weird thing. But like having these milestones and meeting them. Mm-hmm. I'm a weirdo though. All right. So let's talk a little bit about CERTL. So what is CERTL?
So CERTL is a national, now international, because we have some chapters in Canada representing. So I would say it's an international network of research institutions like ours that is dedicated to preparing graduate students and postdocs for teaching positions in higher education or teaching responsibilities in higher education, I should say. And the organization has been around for, let's see, since 2000, so 23 years, and was started through a grant, an NSF grant at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, through the Teaching and Learning Center there, and has now spread to nearly 50 institutions. You know, we have plenty of institutions across the country and also in Canada who represent the organization. And each institution does things a little differently, but the central programming and events and sort of central hub is still in Madison. And it, you know, has kind of spread from there. So yeah, it's really exciting. It's a network that offers opportunities for students to get involved in the scholarship of teaching and learning It also allows them to get exposure to different kinds of pedagogy, workshops, events, webinars, learning communities, you know, all kinds of things that we were talking about previously that we love to do in our own teaching. So that's an easy thing for me to sing the praises of, because I love the kind of community aspect that the organization models for students.
Right.
Yeah.
So could you maybe illuminate anybody who doesn't know what this means? How would you define the scholarship of teaching and learning?
Yeah, so that's such a good question. So the scholarship of teaching and learning, I think, from a very like bird's eye view, is scholarship that looks primarily at student learning, at teacher development, at programmatic outcomes, so through a scholarly lens. So most of the studies in scholarship of teaching and learning are going to be research-based. They draw on literature in the field, and they look at aspects of, let's say, student learning, for instance. So someone might do a study that looks at how well does this technique or intervention make a difference with my student learning, either their perceptions of the content or how well they actually learn the material. How will I know that? How will I assess that? And a study might emerge that could help determine that. And so the CERTL Network really believes in teaching as research, which is a type of SOTL or scholarship of teaching and learning that does look specifically at classroom practices and student learning in an attempt to help the participants become more reflective teaching practitioners. And by reflective teaching, I mean someone who goes into their teaching not just revising their lecture notes year after year and reusing the same thing, but coming with a fresh set of eyes every day to class and thinking, you know, is what I'm doing serving students? Is what I'm doing helping them learn? How can I find out? What kinds of assessments can I use in various ways to see how they're learning and what they're doing? And so that's kind of the way that the CERTL Network, anyway, believes in training future faculty. And I think that's really cool and very unique.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, I think that it's, you know, the scholarship of teaching and learning is definitely a somewhat debated notion, I feel like. But mm-hmm. at the same time, I think that it's an important aspect to teaching is reflecting on what you're doing, finding opportunities to collect feedback on your students and what they are gathering from your teaching practices, and then using that to inform your future decisions as an instructor.
Absolutely. Yeah, they call it kind of an inquiry cycle where you're constantly kind of thinking and asking questions and then revising or looking to the future to see how you can do something better the next time. And I think you're right. I think scholarship of teaching and learning as a field is really interesting. It's a very interdisciplinary field. I mean, people go to graduate school to study, you know, how to become education researchers. And so I think the CERTL Network is very different in that it's not trying to train graduate students and postdocs to become educational researchers. It's trying to teach them in some ways to just engage more deeply with their teaching, be curious about it, research what other people have said about, like, hey, how well does the jigsaw method work in an introductory chemistry course? Or, you know, something, pull some things out of a hat and put them all together. How well does this work in this context? And I think that's kind of the goal, is to just be aware that this field exists and that people are studying teaching and that it is it's a field of inquiry, just like the research that we do in our disciplines.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's great. Yeah. I think it's interesting that graduate students are a target audience here, because I feel like it's so common that graduate students are expected to teach. I mean, in chemistry, they're expected to teach to get paid, but their research is very different from their teaching. And really, a lot of times, the teaching is dismissed. It's not really considered a part of their professional development as graduate students. Even though it's a huge part, I believe it's a huge part of their professional development, in that they are learning how to communicate their discipline. And I think that it starts in the classroom. And I do believe that teaching should be considered some version, some form of professional development among our graduate students and our postdocs, because mostly most postdocs don't teach in any way. Everything begins to focus on their research. So I think it's a really interesting idea to start to focus on graduate students and teaching and professional development surrounding teaching, in terms of creating better and more thoughtful teachers. I think it's really neat.
Yeah, I agree. And the one thing I was going to add, because you mentioned postdocs and the fact that most of them come in are not teaching as part of their job responsibilities, is one of the things that we've also really worked on here is developing a program specifically for postdocs who don't have any meaningful teaching experience. And instead of going the teaching as research or SODL as it's understood track, we developed a program for them that has been surprisingly successful, insofar as we didn't know if we would have a lot of interest from postdocs because A, they're so busy. You know, they're doing research all the time. But we also just didn't know how much interest they would have in learning to teach, because a lot of them are really devoted to their research. And so we developed this one-year program that includes a co-teaching component in the second semester with a faculty mentor. And as part of that, they have to constantly engage with that inquiry model that I was talking about earlier, where they're looking at what's working, what are the learning outcomes, how do we know students are learning things. So they're doing that thinking, they're just not doing it as like a study. But what's been really great is that we went from 2 people the first year to 9 people the second year to 22 postdocs this year.
Wow.
And so we have 44 people co-teaching this semester.
Cool.
On campus, which is really a neat thing because nothing like this existed before that, before CERTL came to campus, and nothing existed like this for them. And it's been really exciting to see them getting involved in things like faculty learning communities and taking programming at UCAT, because before, like, postdocs were really didn't see a need to come to any professional development in teaching because they didn't have a teaching context.
I think I would argue that postdocs do have a role in educating within a research environment.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
And so, I mean, many postdocs will be mentoring and guiding graduate students and also potentially undergraduate students in a research lab or research environment, I should say, because it's not just labs. But they are engaging in mentorship, and mentorship is a form of teaching. Mm-hmm. And so I think that, again, a lot of times in these environments, teaching is considered, this is what you do to get paid, but this is what you should care about. And by this, I mean your research. When in reality, the teaching aspect of their role, whether as a graduate student, they are a TA, or as a postdoc, they are engaging in mentorship activities, it's still teaching and it's a part of their professional development.
Absolutely.
And anybody, I will get off my high horse here in a second, but anybody who gets an advanced degree in anything, in my opinion, will be likely mentoring and teaching others. And you're going to be in a position of leadership, and you're going to have to figure out what that means to you and how you want to do that effectively.
That is so true. It's really important to learn about things like, oh, you know, I do have this expert blind spot, for instance, is the term that we use in pedagogy. Like, how do I communicate this concept to my learners who do not have the same kind of level of experience or knowledge I have? They're coming at this from a completely different perspective. Knowing how to do that takes practice, and it takes understanding how people learn things and, you know, what happens in the brain cognitively when we are learning. I think it's really important, like you said, no matter what teaching context we're thinking about, that knowledge transfer is always happening whenever we talk to people. I think that's so important.
I agree. Yeah, I've never heard it referred to as an expert blind spot.
Yeah.
I've only ever heard it referred to as a curse of knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That you have the curse of already knowing something. And so it's really hard to go back to that spot, that it's really hard to go back to that position of not knowing something and then relating to the learner. So I think it's really interesting. So you have opportunities for postdocs on campus where they can co-teach with faculty. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other opportunities that are out there for either postdocs or graduate students in this program? So I heard you mention that they sometimes participate in UCAD or sometimes they participate in these learning communities.
So when someone decides that they want to get involved with CERTL, they have the option or opportunity to get one, two, or three levels of teaching certification through the network. And the certifications are issued as students do more and more with the network. And so most of the participants who are doing a level one certification are getting a groundwork, are laying a foundation, in other words, for the field of teaching and learning. So we want them to take a course in pedagogy. The CERTL Network offers one with learning communities every fall, which we did this past fall. It was really, really fun and successful, I think. And they will take workshops in aspects of teaching that are interesting to them. So the network offers a lot of workshops on diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI principles. So it could be anything from, you know, taking a workshop on how do I relate better to my neurodivergent students? How can I, you know, prepare materials that are more effective for all my learners, to things like how do I narrow the equity gap in terms of, you know, the students who tend to not do great on tests. How can I, you know, provide alternate assessments or change up my course so that I'm reaching students who aren't just the privileged ones who've been prepared in some ways to take tests. And so that's one thing I like about the network, is a lot of their programming is centered around, their workshops are centered around those concepts. And then we have them for participant learning communities. So either here on campus, you know, people will get together to work on a course together, an online course together every week, or they'll join one of our, you mentioned the faculty learning communities on campus. And so we just ask them to get involved with these things. And then once they finish that level, it requires a final reflection that sort of pulls things together. And then they can move on to co-teach if they want, which is primarily the postdoc community, or to create and actually do a small teaching as research project. And that's something that we're piloting this year as a seminar course in UCAT. So we have five students this semester working on their own teaching as research projects. And they're being guided by myself and Dr. Byron Hempel, who's a professor in engineering.
Yeah, I know Byron.
Yeah, I figured you did. You know, we run in those circles together.
Oh, yeah.
So we're sort of advising five students in this pilot to kind of see how it goes. And then we've also, once students do that, once they successfully do a project, then they can work on preparing a publication or a presentation. And we've had a couple students already publish on work that they've done for CERTL. And it's really exciting to see some of these students kind of take their learning and their interests to a wider public kind of forum and community. So that's really cool. So there are lots of ways that they can get involved, but essentially that's kind of the general framework of what a person's life would look like as they sort of progress through the program.
That's cool. Cause for me, I got my PhD in chemistry, in analytical chemistry.
Yeah.
And once you get your PhD, they kind of shake your hand, say congratulations, and then they just shove you in front of a classroom. And there's really not any training. at least there wasn't for me when I first started. And so they handed me, because I teach general chemistry, which is in a bigger course population. And I teach among other instructors that are using the same curriculum. Then they handed me the curriculum and said, go teach this, without really much of a framework for how to teach, or more importantly, thinking about how people learn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, yeah, it really felt kind of awkward to just go in and start teaching, and you feel like you're supposed to be an expert at something and you're not always great at communicating it. And yeah, so I think it's great to offer this for graduate students, but also for postdocs, because you're better preparing them for these types of careers. So go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say one thing to add to, which is a very valid question. You know, I know, obviously, we all know, having been there as graduate students and postdocs, we're very, very busy people. And something else worth noting is that, oh, this sounds like so much additional work. But one of the cool things that the Sorrel Network has found out, they did a big study in 2016, is that participating in professional development opportunities like this does not impact time to degree whatsoever. So, you know, some students might think, oh, well, if I do this, I'll get behind in my coursework, or I won't finish on time. There has really been no evidence that that's the case.
So it does not impact, even though it's something extra, yeah. It doesn't impact the amount of time it takes them to graduate.
Yeah.
I think if anything, it probably provides them with a greater support system.
Exactly. Yep.
Because I think that a lot of times graduate students, they get siloed in their own discipline, or yep. Even sometimes in their own research groups, and they lack an interaction among other of their cohort within their departments or beyond their departments. And so offering these opportunities, I think, is really an excellent way for them to start building those professional, like, networking skills.
Absolutely. I think that's absolutely right. It gives them a lot of confidence too. That's something that we've seen a lot in our smaller studies here with our program evaluation, is that this kind of professional development, especially when you're a very novice educator, can really help instill a lot of confidence in a way that I did not have when I started out. I had a lot of teaching experience as a graduate assistant in teaching, but not a lot of training. Like you. And it took me years to realize that the focus wasn't on me, that I am not the performer. I don't have to be perfect. I don't have to over rehearse everything. That it's really about student learning and how am I facilitating that. When that finally hit me after I started getting involved in all this professional development, I was like, whoa, hit the brakes. Like, this is great. This is about them, not me.
No, when I surrendered,
that
surrender, like when I finally just said to myself, this isn't about me,
right?
This is about you. Like, I already have a PhD in chemistry. Mm-hmm. I don't need to relearn this. You have, and I changed this. Some happens for me sometime around in COVID. I'm like, I can't do this for you. I can't take the test for you. I can't run the race for you. I'm your coach here. You have to do it. And I'm here to support that and offer my help and my guidance and hopefully activities that help to illuminate to you what you understand and what you don't understand. But that surrender, that final like realization that it wasn't about me, it just was a huge weight off.
Yep. And it's a big confidence boost, because you're like, oh, maybe I can do this. Like, yeah. There are strategies I can use. There are, you know, tips and tricks that other people have tried, you know, that I can adopt for myself. It's kind of like you gain entrance into this community of people who are always willing to share things. I love this community because I rarely meet people who are very proprietary over like, oh, this is my lesson or this is my strategy. It's like, oh, have you tried this? Or, oh, have you thought about this? Which I think is really welcoming and inclusive and wonderful.
Yeah, I heard once early in one of my first faculty learning communities was that teachers are the biggest thieves, because we're constantly taking things from other teachers and using them in our classrooms or adapting them to our own classrooms. And so, yeah, I kind of got used to that notion. And it's also, I think, really important to, you know, adopt these things and adapt them to our own personalities and our own personas. Because I think one of the other things that a lot of times people wrestle with when they first start teaching is they look at a good instructor and they try to model what they do after that person. And sometimes in doing that, they are coming off as unauthentic or inauthentic. I don't know what's the right word, but they're coming off as not being authentic. And the students see right through that you have to find ways to be your own person as the instructor and use these methods that's really authentic to yourself. Otherwise, the students really don't buy into it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that does take time. It takes time to learn who you are as an instructor. So you might as well start early is my philosophy. Get to know yourself in grad school when you're still learning everything. You know, get to know who you are and your philosophy. It'll serve you well, because you won't have to figure all that out when you land your first teaching job, which is going to be a very different experience than any of the work you've done before. So,
and you're going to change. And it's okay to change. It's okay to modify your own ways of being in the classroom as you go, because we're all growing and changing as humans. That doesn't stop once we get a degree. Okay, so one of the things that I was curious about, because you said that you've done like some book clubs about pedagogy and that kind of stuff. Is there a book that you particularly like or enjoy using or a resource that you like to use when working with graduate students or postdocs, or that you recommend?
Yes.
And you're like, how much time do you have?
And I'm like, I have a whole bookshelf right here. So one that I love, this is a very common one, is James Lang's Small Teaching. It's a classic. I mean, you know, it's a good one because, and I think it's a good one to start with for some people, because it's very small. It's these like micro changes that you can make to class that, you know, can help students retain information better or connect the last class that they have already long forgotten to the next class, you know, which they're sitting in at the moment, or to help them think ahead to the next class. So I really like his approach to helping faculty and instructors who are not, or who don't feel like they're experts in teaching, to give them tools to do small things, hence the name Small Teaching. So I do like that one. But I also really like, and this goes back to a conversation we had earlier about translating your expertise and talking about your research and concepts in your courses in ways that students can understand. I think that Jessamyn Newhouse's book, Geeky Pedagogy, does a good job of that. The title of the book is kind of funny, but basically the premise is you are a geek. You love your discipline. You spent like a decade of your life studying this thing. And
sometimes
now you're
longer. Yeah.
Or longer. And now you're going to be teaching students who some may not care whatsoever. Some might be mildly interested. Some might be interested, but don't feel confident. How do you translate that expertise to them?
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really good book for people who are starting out, but it's also great for anybody. I mean, I think it's a good idea to think about, but we've used it a couple times in faculty learning communities with CERTL members specifically. And the book has resonated well with them because we all are geeks. we're all passionate about this one thing. And I guess that's the definition of a geek, is somebody who geeks out about you know, one thing. So I like that because it sort of demystifies the idea that you have to be this charismatic presence in the classroom that's going to change hearts and lives. It's about more like, hey, how do you translate this thing you love into something that students can kind of relate to And I like that approach because it opens up the field to anybody who is interested in teaching. It kind of demystifies like what is a quote unquote good professor and kind of like opens it up for anybody. So I like that book too. I think, and I've met Jasmine a couple of times and she's great.
I like the idea of translating. I teach chemistry and a lot of people view it, oh, it's a science, it's a hard science, it's a lot of memorization. And for me, I almost look at it from a linguistic standpoint that I'm there to translate this weird language that we use. Because we use a lot of language in chemistry that you might also use colloquially. A common example of that is organic. Organic chemistry to chemists means it's carbon-based. Oh. Organic in the grocery store means there's no pesticides used. Pesticides, by the way, are typically carbon-containing compounds, which are organic.
You're blowing my mind here, Amy.
It's a mess. And so in chemistry, we use all this terminology, this jargon, this discipline-specific language that we use. And so I have to translate that, pull that out and say, this is how we're using it in chemistry, and this is what it means. And then use that language to describe completely abstract concepts about things that they can't see or touch. And so I feel like it's a constant translation. And I view myself in a lot of ways as a translator. So that I haven't read that book yet, but I will definitely have to put it on my list. Okay, so I have maybe two more questions. What question is, are there opportunities for CERTL to support faculty or instructors or people who are maybe TA trainers? Does CERTL have resources available for those types of people, not just graduate students or postdocs?
Yeah, that is actually a big question that is going on right now in the national network. A lot of institutions have had sort of, well, to use your word, organically had faculty, particularly new faculty, wanting to come to their events and programming on campus. Like maybe there's a learning community or they want to take one of the courses. And we've even had a few here. We've had a few faculty who've actually are going through the certification program right now. One faculty member that I work with is a faculty in nursing and came from industry, was working in nursing for 20 plus years and was just hired on last January here at the College of Nursing and came to me and said, I know nothing about teaching. I love it. I've done a lot of training at the hospital, but what's pedagogy? What does this mean? And so he actually went through and got the first level of teaching certification in CERTL. And then I invited him to co-lead the learning community with me this fall for one of the online courses that CERTL provides. And so he had taken the course. And so I invited him back as a faculty member the next year to lead the course. So I think that the opportunities are certainly there. I think that the network was not necessarily designed for faculty, but I think as it's evolved over time, it's become more aware that training can happen at multiple points in a career and that some new faculty may come from an institution that, let's say, didn't have a CERTL program or didn't have, you know, other opportunities to develop themselves. And so why not? You know, I think the biggest sort of dissonant voices or concerned voices against opening up the programming, you know, really full scale to everyone is that, you know, I think CERTL doesn't want the grad students and postdocs to feel nervous or insecure, you know, working alongside faculty because they're already nervous and insecure a lot of times when talking about teaching in the first place. So that's kind of where I would say where things are sort of sitting right now. But a lot of places are opening up their programming to interested faculty. And I think it's a great idea.
Yeah. I mean, I think I understand that dynamic. There is a power differential that we cannot ignore between graduate students and faculty or postdocs and faculty. And so it's an intimidating situation. and that aspect shouldn't be ignored. But I think that that's interesting that there are faculty that say, hey, this programming is out here. I want to better myself.
Yep.
And I think that that's great, because I think that a lot of us, again, you get a PhD, they shake your hand, they shove you into a classroom. So exactly. Yeah. All right. My last question is, so what's one of the things that you're most proud of about your career, maybe where you're at right now?
So instead of, I've been thinking about this question, because I knew you were going to ask it of me at some point during your conversation. And I was thinking, you know, there isn't necessarily, like, I could say, oh, I'm really proud of the fact that we've tripled our, you know, postdoc enrollment, you know, or that we have a few students who've published on work that they started in CERTL. Those are all wonderful things. But I think for me specifically, I think what I'm most proud of is that I took a leap of faith. That sounds so cheesy, but I decided to take a leap of faith and follow a path that I didn't necessarily plan for. And it was scary. It was scary to leave behind an English department and say, I'm going to, you know, go this direction. I'm going to veer in another direction and see where it takes me. And I am really proud of myself for doing that, because I am a very anxious, nervous person in general. And I like to plan everything like you do. And I kind of took this sort of turn without a real plan in place. And that's very unlike me, but I'm really glad and proud of the fact that I did that, because I can say I have learned more in the 3 years I've been in this role than probably all the years combined before that, in terms of the people I've met, the opportunities that I've had, the growth that I continue to be able to get. There's so much to learn in this field. And I'm just really glad that I took that leap of faith. I think that that's something I'm really proud of.
Cool. That's great. It's really hard to do that.
Yeah, it is.
It's hard to let, and sometimes it's hard to let go of some of the things that you do that you love.
Yeah.
Like, I've always been very reluctant to give up teaching, because it fulfills me in a way that most other things don't do. But yeah, no, that's I think that is certainly something to be proud of. Taking a leap, not knowing where you're going to land.
And being willing to fail a little bit. I was really scared to be vulnerable before starting this program. Like, everything, I felt like, oh yeah, this has to be perfect. My course has to be perfect. Students have to love me, whatever. And when you're starting up a program from scratch, you're gonna fail. Like, there are things that we tried the first year, let's say, or even last year, so we're in our third year now, that didn't go so well. Like, in a nice euphemistic way, that kind of tanked. Like, we didn't retain the students that we wanted to, or the momentum fell flat, or we didn't use the right marketing terminology when recruiting. And that's also really hard to do if you're coming at it from someone like me or you, who's like, I want to have everything planned. I want to know everything's going to go well.
Yeah.
And in this kind of work, you have to let go of that a little bit, because you don't always know what's going to resonate with people.
Well, and perfection is a myth.
Yeah, so true.
We need to get over that so fast. It's just not real. It's just not even a real thing. But I think that it's so important, though, to, you know, embrace those failures, examine the failures, mm-hmm. because you learn from them.
Yes.
And, you know, one of my teachers when I was first a graduate student used to say, the amount of knowledge gained is directly proportional to the amount of equipment destroyed. And yeah, you learn from the failures. The bigger the price tag on the failure, the more you probably learn. I don't know. So yeah, no, I think that's great. I think that that's a really important thing, and that no matter, whenever you make a pivot, you make a change, it's not going to be perfect. You're going to make mistakes, and that's okay. That's a part of the deal. You have to give yourself the grace to mm-hmm. do that and accept that and just keep going.
Yep, Exactly.
So, well, I think that's a great place to end.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I really appreciate having this conversation with you. And honestly, it's I know you, but I feel like I know you so much better now. And it's just been a wonderful time to talk with you here. Thank you for listening to Pep Talks, where we talk about productive educational practices. Please remember that there is always room for improvement. This is Amy Graham. Take care of yourself.